You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I would like to welcome all of you to Brookings this afternoon. And I also want to especially thank those of you who couldn't join us in person but have decided to tune in through the webcast. We have a really compact and rich discussion for you this afternoon about the future of Detroit. And I want to stress the word future because Detroit has weathered a lot in its past. Deindustrialization, some mass out-migration, a great recession that led to a number of foreclosures and a collapse of the auto industry, bankruptcy. In fact, because all this, former HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros called it about as close a time as any in which the U.S. almost lost a city. The good news is we didn't let that happen. In fact, Detroit may be a harbinger of what is to come, an economic and community revival driven by solutions mostly outside of government. And our program today features these leaders, philanthropic, business, civic, nonprofit, leaders who chose to not give up on the people, the industries, and the rich culture of Detroit. And their efforts are paying off, and we are seeing stories everywhere about what we are calling today hashtag Detroit Resurgence. You know, there was a Washington Post story titled, "For Downtrodden Detroit, Hopes of Revitalization," which was around the Woodward Corridor. There was a New York Times columnist about the spirit and promise of Detroit. And in addition to those stories, the market momentum is also real. You know, Brookings' latest Metro Monitor found that since 2009, the Detroit metro economy is expanding in such a way that Metro Detroit ranks eighth among all metros in the growth of its productivity in its industries, and it ranks number one among metros in the share of workers, or the growth in the share of workers who are now employed. In fact, the share of workers with jobs have increased for both whites and workers of colors in this community. So even though there's a lot more work to be done, there is tangible progress in Detroit's ongoing journey. Now, to help us map what's next for Detroit, we have a two-part program for you this afternoon. First, Rip Rapson, the president of the Kresge Foundation, will unveil a new survey that they are releasing today, the Detroit Reinvestment Index. That index is going to set up a conversation that Rip will moderate among four panelists who are well steeped in the actions in the city. Now, I'm going to go ahead and introduce some of those panelists now so that we can have a seamless conversation once Rip presents the index findings. We have with us today Sandy Barua, who is the president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce and a former director of the U.S. Small Business Administration and the U.S. EDA under President Bush. Stephen Henderson is here with us today. He is the editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press, and he's also won a number of awards, including the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary in 2014. And in fact, that same year, he was chosen by his peers to receive the Journalist of the Year Award from, the National Association of Black Journalists. Quentin Primo is with us this afternoon. He is the chairman and CEO of Capri Investment Group, which is a global real estate investment and management group that is in the middle of right now raising $200 million fund for what they're calling the Detroit Urban Investment Fund. And we're going to learn more about that this afternoon. And last but not least is Jennifer Vey, who is a longtime colleague of ours at Brookings, and she now co-directs the BASS Initiative on Innovation and Placemaking, an evidence-driven effort to pioneer innovation districts in the U.S. and in Europe, including in Midtown and downtown Detroit. Now, there will be time for all of you to ask questions to both Rip and the panelists, so please keep those in mind, including for those of you who are on the webcast. If you're interested in asking questions, please use, again, the hashtag Detroit Resurgence and pose your questions there, and we will be monitoring it over the next hour and a half. I am now going to hand the mic off to my friend and colleague, Rip Rapson, who is going to run the program from here. But before I do, I want to give him a proper introduction. And if any of you have ever been in a meeting with Rip, he has this amazing way of giving sort of a personal touch to the way he introduces people and participants in his room. So what I wanted to say is, not only are we grateful to Rip and the Kresge Foundation for nearly a decade of support and collaboration to our program at Brookings, but he has been a source of inspiration for all of us, dating back to his leadership in Minneapolis. And there's no doubt he has retained his Minnesota nice as he has been dogged with his Midwest grit. And he clearly has shown that in Detroit, not settling for anything less than bold and humane. His tireless commitment to Detroit is evident through Kresge's leadership in everything from transit investments to housing and vacant land reform to small business and entrepreneurship and early childhood education. You know, a few months ago, the Detroit News article called Rip, quote, a visionary. And I agree. So please join me in welcoming Rip Rapson.
Thank you, Amy. That was incredibly nice. And so I have nothing else to say. Thank you. But I do want to thank you and your staff for putting together what we never imagined would be a standing room audience. We deeply appreciate that. This is why we appreciate your staff so much. Thank you. Thank you. But I also just want to return the compliment. It's hard to imagine an institution that has been formative to every important conversation about urban America over the last 20 years. And I've known Amy almost that long, and she has had an indelible tracing effect on, I think, virtually all of the sort of the issues we're going to talk about this afternoon, from economic development to land use to real estate reinvestment and on and on. So we're just delighted to be here, and we're honored to be among so many friends. I see a lot of folks in the audience who actually could be on the panel as well, and so I hope we'll draw you in during the conversation. I want to just, I'm sorry for this, but I want to very quickly thank my team, which is quite an extraordinary team, and we've got hundreds of them here. We've got Jennifer Kulzicki and Christine Jacobs from our communications office, Ari Simon, who's our vice president of programs and chief strategy officer, Aaron Patton, who's affiliated with our executive office, and my old tennis doubles partner, Alan Stone, who I just thought I should bring along because my forehand is really pathetic these days. I also wanted to thank Raul Bafnani of FTI Consulting and his team. They were the ones who fielded the survey of the hundreds of business folks that we're going to talk about over the next couple of moments. Let me say that Kresge's deep commitment to Detroit began very soon after our namesake built his first five and dime store there in 1899. Although we are a national foundation, our core identity has always been tied to Detroit, and proudly so. This is in part why Detroit's resurgence means so much to us, particularly given that we... Alan. Yeah, I think it's... Yeah. That'll teach me to talk about tennis in a major national conversation. But this is in part why Detroit's resurgence means so much to us, particularly given that we were able to play a central role in resolving Detroit's historic bankruptcy with an historic solution, the Grand Bargain. And we're now playing a critical role in designing the strategies and forging the partnerships needed to sustain Detroit's renaissance. You know, at events like the one today, I'm often asked a whole suite of questions having to do with how philanthropy helped save a city that was swamped by the tsunami of seemingly intractable problems that Detroit faced, how solving problems in Detroit might provide hints for addressing the huge challenges that other cities face, and how we might best ensure that this recovery remains robust and inclusive and sustainable for our children and beyond. And that's really why we've structured the panel we have today. I think we want to pivot from the findings of the poll to exactly those sorts of questions. But let me help build a surround for that conversation by laying out the fascinating findings of our first Detroit Reinvestment Index that Amy spoke about, which can be found at kresge.org/reinvest, where you can find the comprehensive data set and additional analysis. It's important to note at the outset that the engagement of business with Detroit has been pervasive and profound since at least 1820. People sometimes forget that the reason Henry Ford picked Detroit was because its economy at that time was at strong, not in 1820, but a little bit later, was as strong and diverse as anywhere in the nation. We gathered this snapshot in time, pulling data in that spirit. We see the poll as having a number of purposes. It takes stock of public perceptions surrounding Detroit, particularly in its post-bankruptcy phase. It creates a benchmarking tool to understand the impact of public-private revitalization efforts to date and in the future. It seeks to capture lessons of what's worked and what hasn't worked in Detroit and share those key findings with others engaged in reinvigorating urban communities. And it attempts to determine how national business leaders, a critical component of Detroit's rebound, see the city today. So with caveats I'm going to go into in a bit, I think it's fair to say that business is very bullish on Detroit. Here's why I say that. First, nearly three-quarters of the business leaders we polled believe Detroit is a good place to invest. Three-quarters. Second, the top characteristic they use to describe Detroit is a city in economic recovery. Third, nearly 85% are confident that Detroit can become a great city again. And that number goes up to 95% if you just count the top CEOs we surveyed. And fourth, going even further, almost 100% believe that all cities are capable of overcoming the most serious of challenges, an optimism about cities that gives so many of us in this room great hope. What makes these positive findings even more remarkable is that we also learned that only 16% of business leaders outside of Detroit were aware that the city has actually emerged from bankruptcy. Newsflash to America, we have. And we accomplished that consensually and at warp speed. One can only assume that once that fact is more widely absorbed by the public, the findings will be even more positive. As it is, results like these will help continue the change narrative about Detroit. I strongly believe that investment comes to a place that possesses a sense of optimism, and the Detroit of today embodies that sense of possibility. After seeing these initial overall findings, we wanted to dig a little deeper into the data and tease out not just the fact that business leaders are bullish about Detroit, but why. I don't think we found, or actually we could find, direct causality between these findings and the feelings behind them, but I think we found some very suggestive possibilities. First, an enormous percentage of business people have a connection to Detroit. Almost 50% of the business leaders we question have or have had business operations or have made investments in Detroit. And between visiting Detroit for business or pleasure and having families or friends in the area, more than 90% of business leaders we polled have some relationship with Detroit. Second, they like what they're hearing about the city. We asked everyone to evaluate their general impressions of Detroit from all they've read or heard lately. Two-thirds said that their impressions of Detroit had become more favorable recently. Among many conclusions one could draw from this is that although they don't necessarily know precisely that Detroit has emerged from bankruptcy, they do know that the news is better than it might have been or better than they might have expected. Third, the essential identity of Detroit is real to business leaders. When given a list of the various characteristics that people value in cities, Detroit was rated highest by nearly 75% of business leaders for having a rich cultural history and for being ethnically and racially diverse and vibrant. In other words, business leaders get Detroit. Regardless of the city's recent struggles, what Detroit is and what it stands for remain a powerful presence in their lives. And that's great news. But we also have to be honest about and acknowledge that there are serious concerns that the poll raises as well. For example, we probed the business leaders on what they look for when measuring the health of communities, the strength of the economy, and the likelihood of getting ahead in a city. It turns out that the feature they are most looking for in almost every instance is a low crime rate, and there Detroit falls short. 80% believe that a low crime rate is essential for success, but only 52% rate Detroit as excellent or good on that dimension. Similarly, there remains a significant gap between the importance business leaders place on the role of an effective local government and the creation of a sound municipal budget and what they perceive Detroit's performance to be for each. Now, obviously, these are sobering findings, but they're not unexpected. The city has made considerable progress in multiple measures of safety and is once again in the hands of responsive and competent municipal government. Yet, we continue to work in the shadow of a long period of political dysfunction and corroded municipal services. So at the same time we take satisfaction in the very good news in this survey, we recognize that we have to be clear-eyed about the challenges it spells out and the need to take them head-on as we move forward. As I mentioned earlier, these data are a part of a larger effort Kresge is undertaking to share lessons with other cities across the country about what we've learned from our experiences in our hometown. Those lessons are tied to a handful of building blocks that Detroit has put in place over the last 7 years to spur its resurgence. We'll talk about these again in the panel in just a moment, but let me just provide the quickest of flyovers. We've recalibrated the roles and responsibilities of the public, private, nonprofit, and philanthropic sectors, creating a model of distributive leadership that optimizes what each of those sectors does best and elevates the importance of partnerships among them. We've invested in the residential and commercial vitality of downtown and along Woodward Avenue, creating the preconditions for the market to return to Detroit. We've developed a land use framework to power planning and investment decisions to convert the city's vast swaths of blighted land into productive uses such as green-blue infrastructure, reclamation of abandoned homes for community purposes, public spaces and reforestation, and urban farming. We've begun channeling greater investments into Detroit's neighborhoods, animating our land use strategies through expansive blight remediation efforts, innovative support for home mortgages, targeted commercial corridor development, and innovative reuse of abandoned and vacant land. We've created a sophisticated and effective entrepreneurial and small business development infrastructure that has created a flywheel of small business formation, from restaurants to startups, from arts and cultural centers to barbershops and bakeries. And we've taken the first step toward creating a comprehensive and equitable public transportation system through our investment in the M1 light rail line that will run along Woodward and open next year, and many others. So I believe that the forces propelling the rebirth of Detroit over these last 7 years were crystallized in the resolution of Detroit's bankruptcy, when the very unlikely mix of foundations and unions, a museum, and municipal and state government came together to pull Detroit through an existential crisis that could have catapulted a once great city into a decade-long spiral of litigation, investor uncertainty, and government paralysis. The rapid and consensual resolution of that crisis was a precondition to all else. It put us in the starting blocks, and it began erasing what had heretofore been indelible images of entropy and apocalypse too long associated with Detroit. These poll results suggest that we have every reason to believe that we can move out of those starting blocks and begin what is in part sprint, but mostly a marathon. Certainly, the citizens of Detroit believe that we have taken the initial, vitally important steps in that direction. It's uplifting to see that business leaders across America believe it as well and appear at the ready to embrace Detroit's new arc of aspiration. So with that framing, let me ask our panelists to come on up, and we'll try to get into the nuts and the bolts of what all of this means. Come on up, y'all. I do want to underscore that I hope people will be prepared to get into the mix. There is nothing like Detroit to provoke strong feelings, different perspectives, and unusual insights. So please get into the mix. I think what I'd like to do, I'm trying to think of who to start with. Actually, Stephen, I may start with you. As Amy mentioned in the setup, Stephen has probably been the closest observer in our community of both the good and the bad, and has written with, I think, a fairly uncompromising pen about the struggles we face. And so on one hand, Stephen, you look at these poll results, and they're encouraging, right? I mean, people outside the system looking in feel that there's real progress that has been made and that can be made. And yet every day you're writing on your editorial page and on your front page about issues that hold the possibility of tearing all of that apart. I mean, how do you balance these two kind of conflicting images of a place?
I think the two conflicting images and the two conflicting narratives are really the story right now in Detroit, right? The bankruptcy sort of sucked all the air out of the room for a really long time, and we were talking about municipal finance and the structure of government and competent governance. But now that that's over and we have more stable governance, it's time to sort of look deeper into the sort of structural issues that hold the city back. I continue to believe that this is a call to sort of invest in the people of Detroit as opposed to the institutions or government, and that there are some fundamental weaknesses in that realm that we have got to deal with. You think about the school system in the city, the devastation that's been sort of visited upon that school system. I covered Detroit Public Schools for the Free Press when I was a young reporter in the early 1990s. There were 281 schools and 170,000 students. Today there are 47,000 students. Almost 50,000 kids go to charter schools. The choices that you have as a parent, I'm also a parent raising two kids in Detroit, and so I deal with the choices you have to make all the time about schools. You can't just send your kid to the school around the corner and trust that that's going to work. The literacy rate among people in the city, 47% are functionally illiterate, which doesn't mean that they can't read. But it does mean that they don't read well enough to perform most jobs. And so even attracting jobs to the city faces a hurdle in terms of getting employees, qualified employees, people who can actually do the work. The transit problem that we face in Detroit, which is just spectacular. I mean, it is really difficult if you live in Detroit and are poor. It's very difficult to get to the places where jobs actually exist, and that's sort of by design. I mean, we've got two separate transit systems that don't work very well together. We have communities in the suburbs who choose to opt out of that transit system because they don't want people coming there. These are the kind of things that we've got to start really thinking about in Detroit if we're going to capitalize on this interest that people around the country have in us. You know, it's great that people are coming and wanting to invest. We were ignored for a really long time. But for it to work, we've got to resolve some of those core issues. And again, resolve the isolation and the poverty, the deep isolation and poverty that people in the city still experience all the time.
I mean, you know, when I first came to Detroit 10 years ago, this was clearly the dominant narrative, that these challenges were so intractable and so deep-rooted that it was almost impossible to kind of figure out where to start. And I know at Kresge, we made the decision to actually move to some of the hardwiring, to the transit system, to the housing stock, to the commercial corridors, to the creation of tax base. And I'm wondering, Sandy, if your membership sort of gets uncomfortable by the sort of the difficulty of the narrative, or does it sort of take the sort of the view that I think we took, which was you got to start somewhere, you got to make some investments stick, you've got to create these flywheels, that's an interesting concept, flywheels of of investment that permit markets to feel comfortable and feel the sense of opportunity to get paid back at market rates? I mean, how would you characterize sort of the business community's attitude?
Yeah, so a lot to unpack there. So I guess the framework that I would start with that, Rip, is from a business community perspective and from our organization's perspective, the whole idea of going into financial management and bankruptcy was actually something that we were, might regret saying this, we were actually excited about. And it was an interesting situation for a business organization. You know, we're a chamber of commerce. We're the economic development organization for the 11 counties in Southeast Michigan. So we're essentially the front door, if you will, for Southeast Michigan, the city of Detroit. And for us to be kind of vying for bankruptcy, you know, egging the governor on, saying, yes, we need emergency management. Yes, we need bankruptcy, kind of went contrary to what, you know, a lot of business organizations might, you know, what might their ethos be? Because, you know, most business organizations, you know, that are representing a region or representing a place, and what do? You're trying to market that region. You're trying to sell that region. Well, if you're in bankruptcy, it's not exactly a great marketing opportunity for you, right? But we actually thought just the opposite. It's that because, you know, what we were fairly convinced of is that, listen, the day that bankruptcy is filed, and it hits the front page of the Wall Street Journal, the average guy or gal walking down the street of Denver or Phoenix isn't going to look at the Wall Street Journal and read Detroit's gone bankrupt and be shocked. And we had this ethos that there was really no more national news to be made with another negative story about Detroit. All the negative stories about Detroit have been told and retold. And, you know, we kind of felt that, you know, the nation was suffering from what we call Detroit fatigue, right? So we said, listen, the way to solve Detroit's PR problem was to actually start fundamentally solving Detroit's problems and not worrying about the PR. And, you know, emergency management and bankruptcy was very much a tool in which to do that. Now, realizing that bankruptcy is just a tool, it is just a tool to fix part of your problem. And, you know, and I use this example a lot when I'm in Detroit, but I'll try to use it here. I'm in Washington, D.C. I'll use an automotive analogy. So we had automotive companies that went bankrupt. You know, we all know that. And, you know, if an automotive company that had gone bankrupt, and let's take General Motors, for example, if General Motors had all they had done was, you know, did their bankruptcy, all they would have done is fix their books. If they hadn't fixed their fundamental business, if they hadn't fixed the fundamental product that they put out on the street, in other words, are they building a better Malibu today than they were 10 years ago? And I think if I ask that question just to anybody, would they say it? Absolutely. They fixed the product that they put on the street. So bankruptcy was a tool, a part of a broader set of tools that were employed to kind of, you know, reformat and put the city on a trajectory to success. I mean, we're not there yet. I think, you know, there's a lot of great interest in Detroit. I think if you talk to the mayor, if you talk to organizations like ours, you know, you'll hear stories of people kind of knocking on the door, wanting to come visit. Hey, how did you do it? You know, what did you do? And we're a little hesitant in some cases to tell the story because in some cases, one, we're not quite sure how it all came together. So certainly it was very purposeful. But people ask, what was your secret sauce? What was your magic strategy to get that done? It's like, well, listen, if I knew that or if I had that answer, they'd be paying me a lot more money. There was a lot of purposeful actions, but I'm not quite sure what the strategy was to come together. So that's one aspect of it. We're a little hesitant to kind of tell the story, but it did happen, but we're on that path, even though it's not, we're far from out of the woods yet.
So, Quentin, it's one thing to tell a better story. It's another thing to put in place sort of the building blocks that a serious market rate investor feels will ultimately carry return. So how do you take apart these findings and putting them back together? Is this the way your company looks at the world, or are you seeing something different in Detroit that is underneath these findings?
Well, first, to Stephen's points, about the issues with the social, economic, and other infrastructure. Many cities in the Northeast Quadrant suffer from these things. Certainly transportation, not, perhaps not so much so. But the issues with schools and housing, these are issues that major urban cities in the United States suffer from. So Detroit should not be too critical of itself with respect to those issues. As an investor, it's our job to be dispassionate. We are investing on behalf, as fiduciary, large institutional investors that look for us to deliver high risk-adjusted returns. And when we look at Detroit, there are three very strong arguments to invest in the city. One is economic, one is markets, and then a third is I'll generally call qualitative. With respect to the economics, unquestionably, unassailably, the engine of demand for real estate, for commercial real estate, is job growth. And the region, the state, has been unparalleled in the jobs it has created. I think since 2010, Michigan, the state of Michigan, has created something like 45,000 new jobs, which puts it on par with Boston and San Jose, which are very much tech and other industry driven, as some of the fastest growing areas in the country. In the city of Detroit, you've had Quicken Loans at 12,000 jobs in the urban market. Blue Cross Blue Shield at 3,400 jobs. GM just announced its tech center, which will be in Warren, but that's going to add 2,600 jobs. So job creation has been robust over the last 5 years in the city and in the region in an unbiased look. Okay. From a property market standpoint, the market is grossly undersupplied because it's been uninvested in. The area which we're most interested in is the housing area, multifamily rental housing. And there, just to kind of look at it in terms of ratios, Detroit has something like 150,000 daytime working population in the downtown area, and has something like 20,000 units of housing, both rental and for sale. That produces something like a 7.5-to-1 ratio of downtown working population to existing housing stock. L.A. is considered a very hot downtown market right now. It's the Staples Center, and it's kind of resurging, and many institutional investors are investing in downtown L.A. Well, the numbers there, there's about 200,000 people working in the daytime in downtown L.A., and they have roughly 40,000 units of housing, both rental and for sale, so a factor of 5-to-1, okay? And that's a hot market. So the market in Detroit is underserved. The multifamily apartment market is now something like 2.7% vacant compared to a national average of 5%. There's just no units for these millennials and these empty nesters who are increasingly moving into the city to live. So that's an opportunity, completely unbiased look. Thirdly, in terms of a qualitative assessment, the fact that Detroit has emerged from a bankruptcy is a good thing. Investing in countries and companies.
So you actually knew we had emerged from bankruptcy?
Yes, indeed. You look at people don't remember that Orange County went bankrupt. You know, that beautiful Orange County with its rolling hills and beautiful streets and roads and grassy knolls and all this sort of stuff and ocean and mountains. Orange County was bankrupt, okay, and investors, it avoided it. Well, slowly but surely, they began to invest, and now it's an extraordinary success story. Another qualitative factor is that as Brookings has celebrated its celebrates its 100th year anniversary, 1916 to 2016. 1916 was also the years that the Great Migration of black people leaving the Jim Crow South started. The Great Migration has its centennial this year. It ended in 1970. And Detroit has been so critical to not only the creation and being the birthplace of the American middle class, it's also been the birthplace of the black middle class. And even though we dispassionately look at cities, The fact that there are so many black people and people of color living in Detroit, we believe that has been a deterrent to traditional institutional investors investing. And so as an advisor of color, okay, as a diverse advisor to institutional investors, we look at that and we look at it dispassionately. We see economic opportunity, we see investment opportunity, irrespective of who lives there. We see Detroit as an American emerging market, a domestic emerging market versus a global emerging market. And as institutional investors invest in India and Africa and Eastern Europe and places far away from the United States that are emerging, we think they should also be investing in an emerging Detroit. So these are all, again, dispassionate, quantitative reasons why we as first movers are moving into the city aggressively.
So, Jennifer, I don't want to just go seriatim, but I can't help it because so you've got sort of this cauldron of complexity of education, neighborhood job creation, literacy rates. You've got the sort of the need to kind of reset the equilibrium of municipal government and finances and everything else coming out of bankruptcy. You have this sort of hot market because for a long time Detroit was so depressed that sort of young folks could come in and buy a house for $10 and start a business. I mean, you've watched other communities sort of go through these cycles up and down. Is this just a, sort of a classic sort of post-traumatic event bubble that is just going to sort of collapse? Or do you have the sense that there is some trajectory that is makes sense here as we look at the future?
Sure. I mean, I think when we look at these issues, I think we're really talking about something that's much more sustained than just some ebb and some part of the ebb and flow. If you look back at where cities were, you know, many decades ago, look, you know, the cities that we think of today as being our hot market cities, the places everybody wants to be, everybody wants to live. You know, these were cities themselves during the 70s and 80s went through their own struggles. Look at New York, look at Boston, look at any of these cities. And it was during the 90s where we started to see those front runners sort of coming out, right? We were seeing it in everything from the entertainment industry on down to people starting to recognize the value of urban living again and some of these cities turning around their economies, many of which were also, you know, industrial economies, and seeing populations start to revalue these cities. But you were still seeing your true post-industrial cities, many of which were in the Northeast and Midwest, lagging behind. And even that started to shift and pivot in largely in the 2000s. And you started to see other cities around the country, particularly in their downtown areas, even if it wasn't the city as a whole, we were starting to see that growth in downtowns, whether it was in Center City, Philadelphia, or what was happening in, you know, even in places like downtown Cleveland, in smaller cities, in downtown Baltimore. You were starting to see that trajectory begin to change. And now you can, you know, look ahead and see where we are now. And I think there's a lot of reasons that are driving a lot of these shifts. And, you know, one, picking up on your point about the demographic shifts and preferences. Certainly, this is something that's probably the most well known. We focus a lot on the millennials, but there's truth to this that you have a reevaluation of cityness or cities and all that goes with that from certain sectors of the and certain demographics who just want something different than maybe their parents wanted, and that's certainly been driving some of these trends. But we're also seeing a lot of shifts in the market itself. You know, as Amy referenced, my focus is really around the economy and particularly around the innovative economy. And what we're seeing in many of these cities is that as the economy has shifted to one that is, you know, certainly we're moving out of the post-industrial economy to an economy that's far more dominated by technology that's running through all different sectors. Right, so it's not just certainly the tech economy, but it's the information economy and the tech economy that's being intertwined with everything from health to energy to the fashion industry. And so as that economy has changed, what we're also then seeing is within that a lot more openness in the innovative economy. And so it's actually what it's really starting to cause is a shift in where firms, and not just their workers, but firms themselves, where they want to be located. So if we think about the innovation economy dating back, you know, going back to the mid part of the 20th century, coming out of the World War II era, a lot of our most innovative companies were locating out in the suburbs. And part of this was just reflecting the trends at the time, the residential trends, and just the trends of our economy, again, the move out of cities. And part of it was the nature of innovation itself, where the idea was keeping your secret secret, keeping your innovation more closed. And so now we have a much more, the innovative economy is much more open than it used to be and is demanding much more collaboration than it was in the past. So a lot of R&D may not even be housed in firms anymore. Rather they're looking for big pharmaceuticals and firms and other major firms are looking for that innovation to be happening, you know, in the startup community or out of anchor institutions. And so what's happening is you're seeing that, again, the valuing of cities and density in ways that we weren't seeing many decades ago. And so I think it's, you know, to your question of whether or not this is something of kind of a blip or whether it's something that's more sustained, if we think about the fact that that one, we've got a large millennial population that's still coming up, we have a much more diverse society than we had before, and that trajectory is continuing. At the same time, you're seeing these fundamental shifts in the economy that I don't think we're going backwards anytime soon. So it's because of this that I think a lot of these trends back towards, you know, a more urban type of environment, whether that's happening in cities or whether that's happening in dense enclaves outside of cities, I think what we're seeing is something that is much more sustained over the long term.
Maybe Stephen and Sandy, play this out a little bit, because again, when I came to Detroit, it was still Motor City, right? It was dominated by the autos. It was a command and control system. There was very little diversification to the economy. When you look 10 years later now, we have, as you suggested, Sandy, a kind of a retooled auto economy, maybe more nimble, looking at different product, looking at different qualitative issues. But I have heard a lot of people say to me that Detroit is too far behind, that if you want to be Raleigh, if you want to be Portland, if you want to be Seattle, even if you want to be Baltimore and Johns Hopkins, you know, that's just not within your reach. Is that true? Or if it isn't, why not?
Well, I think, you know, the point you made about, you know, cities transforming themselves, I mean, you know, the two cities I know best other than Detroit are the two cities I've spent most of my life in, and that's this city, Washington, and Portland, Oregon. And both those cities, you know, transformed themselves in my lifetime, and I see exactly that same kind of pattern taking place in Detroit. So I don't think we're too far behind at all. I mean, you know, as Stephen so eloquently and rightly says, there are certainly, you know, systemic challenges that need to be addressed. On the auto issue that you raised, which I think is a really fascinating one, and I've spent a lot of time talking and kind of examining the auto industry. So we all know the auto industry is changing dramatically, and it's going to change, frankly, in our lifetimes. I mean, we're moving from a product-based business to a service-based business, and that is going to fundamentally transform our society in the same impact the way the internet has transformed our society. It's also going to change our companies. You know, our companies, no matter where you are in the auto industry, it is going to change your company. It's going to change your company because, you know, right now, you know, auto companies, be it be based in Germany or the United States or Japan, you know, they're used to, or they were used to, this kind of very product-based thing. You'd go out and buy a Ford Fusion or a Cadillac or a Toyota or whatever it is, and you'd buy it, and it would sit 92% of the time. It would depreciate, and, you know, then you get another one of those. You kind of rinse, cycle, repeat, right? You know, that model's going to go away. So our companies are in the process now of really looking at, you know, what do the companies need to do to kind of adapt and win in this global connectivity environment, the autonomous vehicle, transportation, mobility as a service. The special challenge that our region has, the Detroit region has, is that every other region, particularly the United States, that is focused on kind of the next generation of mobility, they're only focused on the next generation piece. What we have to do, which is going to be our big challenge in Detroit and in Michigan, and frankly, you know, in kind of the surrounding area of the Great Lakes region, is that it really matters today how many Ford Fusions and how many Chevy Malibus we sell this year and next year. So if you're the head of a tier one automotive supplier, which, I mean, these are tech companies now, or an OEM, an original equipment manufacturer like, you know, like Ford or General Motors, you get up as a senior executive every day asking yourself a really fundamental question. How much time am I going to spend answering my shareholders' demands for today and tomorrow, which is how many Fusions I sell today, and what is next year's Fusion going to look like, feel like, and what kind of technology is that going to have in it, versus how much time am I and my senior team going to spend on transforming this company from a product-based company to a service-based company, from transforming us from a kind of a self-drive, you know, you drive your car to an autonomous kind of entity, right? Whereas, you know, if you're Silicon Valley, if you're in Austin, or if you're in Boston, or if you're in my hometown of Portland, Oregon, they're only focused on the next generation thing. They're not worried about how many Fusions we sell this year or next year. That, I think, is our biggest challenge, because the opportunity is phenomenal. And what most people don't realize is that in kind of the war, if you will, for next generation connected vehicles, Detroit and the Detroit region is way ahead of any other place on the planet. You know, there's 375 research facilities, you know, and there's more engineers being focused on this right now. There's more testing going on right now. There's more testing facilities going on right now. I mean, there's more of that happening in real time in the Detroit region than any place else. So we're in the lead right now, but we have to balance these two things, and it is a really difficult balancing act.
And I realize, Stephen, that Sandy's got to sort of take the regional view. But when you sort of put what you opened with on top of what Sandy just said, there seems like a
we
pretty sharp disconnect.
We are falling behind. I mean, there's no question we're way behind. Quentin was talking about the 150,000 people who work in the downtown, midtown area, the core part of the city. I saw a stat recently that 85% of those people don't live in Detroit. They come in from the suburbs. 85% of the jobs in Detroit are held by people who live outside, which leaves, you know, 650,000-700,000 people with very few employment options. You talk about density being one of the things that you're trying to create in cities. That's attracting people and investment back to cities. Density is one of our major problems in Detroit. We have 140 square miles that used to hold 2 million people. Now it holds 650 or 700,000 people. So you have 40 square miles, roughly, of nothingness, entire blocks that are gone. I mean, these are, and I agree with Quentin that these are problems that cities all over America face. They look really different in Detroit. It really is just not comparable to any other place that I've lived or worked. And again, this idea of that opportunity gap. I mean, you talk about what is the unemployment rate in Michigan, it's going way down. It's gone way down as it has nationwide since the recession. But for black men in Detroit, it's over 30%. Some people would say it's 50%. I'm not sure I believe that number. One in three black men in Detroit has a felony on his record. So the opportunities for jobs there are diminished. I mean, these are the fundamental kinds of again, social problems that are eating at the city and have been eating at the city for six, seven decades, and we have not faced that. And I don't think that the things that we're doing now in terms of investing in you know, a new economy, the sort of growth that's other places, is going to address that. We've got to do that separately, and we have to have almost a you know, a dual train of investment, one into these structures that will rebuild downtown and the sort of core of the city, but the other that rebuilds the community, the people of Detroit. And investing in people, of course, is really, really difficult. It's a super difficult sell. I sit on the board of an organization called Reading Works, which is an agency that's trying to coordinate literacy programs in the city so that they work together, so that they measure the results and the outcomes, so that we move the needle on that 45% functional literacy rate. I will tell you that it is, you know, tin cup in hand out asking for money. And the thing that people say, the philanthropic community, the business community, is that's a huge problem, but that's government's problem. And we are not in the business of now supplanting a government obligation. Well, you know, government got out of the business of literacy programs 2 decades ago. They're not coming back. If you want to invest in that, we've got to get philanthropic money. We've got to get private sector, for-profit money into that to move people to the kind of opportunity that everyone else is talking about up here.
Let's pivot just a hair off of that and talk about the public sector. We've got Cliff Kellogg and, like, the entire federal team dedicated to Detroit in the room. It's been a remarkable story of the federal government trying to figure out leverage points to be helpful in Detroit and figure out new ways of delivering services. You've got a mayor who is competent and bulldogish on virtually all of the basic municipal services. I mean, I gotta believe that from the outside, that makes a difference, that the public sector is sort of resuming its rightful role, working in a way that sort of promises to sort of stabilize market value, all of the kinds of things you mentioned, Quentin. It is important, is it not? And how do you think about that? How important is both federal and local government role in all of this?
Please.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah. I think it's obviously extremely important. But let me just say that what I think is infinitely more important is the partnership between government, business, and philanthropy to a certain extent. And I think, you know, I'm biased, but I believe it's got to be driven by business ultimately, because business creates the jobs that produce economic development and improve communities. And I, you know, to your earlier question, you know, is it too early, too late? I don't think it can ever be too early or ever be too late. And I say that because my great city, Chicago, where we have our company based, Chicago, which also was one of the fastest growing cities in the world in the mid to late 1800s, burned to a crisp in 1871, made our great fire. And it took us nearly 40 years to produce something called the Plan for Chicago, which was affectionately called the Burnham Plan, because it was an urban plan created by Daniel Burnham, working for the Commercial Club of Chicago. So in 1910 or so, 1905, the Commercial Club got together and said, listen, we got to do something about this city. It's crumbling. It burnt once. It's still not much better. It's been a victim of its own success, given its great location, its access to fresh water, its transportation, all the great things that make Chicago an extraordinary city. It was just simply a victim of its own success. So we decided that we need to create, without government funding, we need to create a plan for Chicago. And then we're going to have to convince government to get on board with us to create this, because obviously it cannot be done in and of itself. And so the Plan for Chicago was created, and what was formerly gin joints and in industry and all sorts of things on the front facing the lake, along the lakefront where we had all our industry. Burnham suggested creating a 22-mile park, you know, outlandish suggestion, and that we create neighborhoods that are themed. We have a central business district, and we have residential districts, and we have a grid system that's easy to understand and follow, that we have boulevards that traverse the grid system. All that came from the minds of the business community and ultimately convinced government to get on board. And what I see in Detroit that I don't see in many cities in the United States is this wonderful partnership, and it's of late. It's not something that's been around for a long time. There was typically great animosity between government or business and business. But I see it not only with Dan Gilbert, you know, not only with the Ilitch family, but much more broad-based than that. And I think that partnership is going to ensure, in my opinion, that Detroit is going to be a great city again. And let me say that, you know, again, as a dispassionate investor, it's not all, you know, we don't look at everything in rose-colored glasses. It's not all great. And certainly many of the issues that Steve points out are critical. But just simply from a market standpoint, it's a small city. So, you know, it can be overbuilt very quickly, right? So there are ills, there are clearly issues and risks that are inherent in the city. But again, we believe that partnership over the course of time will be very beneficial.
I can't help but think, Jennifer, when you look at a place like Pittsburgh with the Allegheny Conference, just, you know, example after example, sometimes I think the government tends to think that it can kind of shoulder this, right? That's its job. That's why they hold their election certificate. But at the end of the day, unless you've got the Roger Penske's and the Dan Gilberts and the Pete Carmonas's, unless you've got the hospital leadership, the educational institutional leadership, and I do think Quentin's right. I mean, I think in this last decade or so, there has been an unusual coalescence of interest, but it also threatens to sort of recalibrate these relationships, right? That the government has, I think, a hard time dealing with a way of sort of distributing responsibility and inviting lots of people to the table. And I don't want to force a question, but it just seems to me that we would probably do well to learn from other communities that have structured their relationship among the sectors a little bit differently. Because when you mention Baltimore, you can't think about Baltimore without Johns Hopkins. When you think about Boston, you can't think about it without the educational institutions and the economic drivers that they bring to the table. So do you see that in Detroit, or is it not yet present?
No, I think to exactly your point, I think this is something that is becoming really well recognized in Detroit, particularly over the last several years, is the different stakeholders coming together. And you can see it in the partnerships around the M1 rail line and how that actually came to be. You know, I think it, sort of piecing together both these conversations and how this, you know, how these stakeholders come together in ways that both help grow the city but also make sure that more people are participating in it, that's where you really see the importance of all these partnerships. Because there is, you know, there is no trickle-down effect. Right. I mean, when we look back at, you know, particularly a lot of my work is focused on older industrial cities and as they were beginning to, you know, pivot or as we were focusing on how that could happen, we focused a lot on the economic piece, rightly so. Right. That's where these places need to start. They need to start readjusting their economies. And so clearly we know that, you know, that has to be the starting point. To your point, it does have to be led by business and by the industries that we really want to grow. I mean, we certainly talk a lot at Brookings about, look, places really have to understand what their major assets are, what their industry strengths are, particularly in the type of advanced industries where you're seeing that drive a lot of the job growth and drive a lot of the good job growth. And that's clearly what you're seeing, you know, that dynamic happening in a lot of these cities. But what we've learned is it's not enough. That I think we had some assumption that as these cities started to turn their economy around, that it would start to lift all boats. And what we've seen is that really hasn't happened. And we know it by the national statistics. We know what's happening on the ground in cities like Detroit and in all cities in terms of the dichotomy between high income and low income and how that actually, the spatial ramifications of that dichotomy as well. And this is where, you know, it's so vital to talk about how all the different stakeholders come together, whether it's your anchor institutions and the role that they play, you know, across the board, not just as employers, but in terms of their role as, you know, from, you know, in research, in the commercialization research, in startup activity, which we're increasingly seeing their, you know, the role of, that they play in collaborating with firms to grow these type of industries that places want. It's certainly in the public sector and them setting the basic platform to allow this growth to happen, whether it's through the regulatory environment, certainly through the public school system, which we know in most of these cities faces its struggle. It's in the nonprofit sector and the workforce programs and their ties to education that help begin to connect lower-income people or minorities to the jobs as they grow. So it's really an all hands on deck approach, where you really need, you know, all these different stakeholders to be coming together, hopefully working under a common vision around the kind of economy that cities and regions want to grow, and how they can grow an economy that is inclusive, that's an economy for all. And that certainly government can't do alone, and the business community can't do alone. It's all these sectors coming together and understanding what their unique and powerful role can be, to be connecting people from you know, across the spectrum, from business development to jobs to workforce to the physical connectivity.
Please, yeah, go ahead, and then why don't people kind of prime themselves for questions, and we'll pivot into the audience.
Cue up. So just building on Quentin and Jennifer's comments, you know, on, you know, you go back 10 years and further back. I mean, you know, clearly, you know, Detroit was a city driven by the big three auto companies, right? You know, kind of what they said, and that's been referenced on this stage. And it's very much true. But, you know, over time, you know, the business community, you know, really kind of lost interest, if you will, in the city of Detroit. And, you know, obviously the story about the disinvestment was very real. And I think part of it is that business leaders, you know, one, just got tired of hitting their head against the wall, not really getting anywhere in terms of being able to move the needle or working with local government. And then, of course, then there was the long-term decline and collapse of the auto industry that made them less of a power. What happened in terms of the kind of the revitalization, if you will, of the business leadership was fascinating. It didn't come from the traditional auto sector. Mm-hmm. You know, first of all, philanthropy, and we haven't really talked about the incredible role philanthropy has played in leading the resurrection of Detroit. I mean, Rip and his colleagues in philanthropy have been hugely important because they started investing way before any of the businesses did. But it was really the Dan Gilberts of the world, the Quicken Loans, that said, "Oh, listen, I'm going to come downtown. We're seeing the flight back into cities. You know, Detroit is Michigan's biggest city. We need to invest in the city." And then, so philanthropy led the way. A handful of businesses, non-traditional businesses, kind of led with their pocketbooks. You know, that then, and I don't know if we were just lucky or good or if there was some divine strategy that we just didn't know. But, again, it was purposeful. You know, we got the right people in the right elected positions, both in the governor's office and in the mayor's office, which was transformative. That got other business investment to come in. And then, part of it was that everyone, from the public sector to the private sector, is that, we're willing to try something new. We're willing to try something different. We elected a governor back in 2010, never held office before. He called himself a nerd, and frankly, he was overselling himself, calling himself a nerd. it sometimes is a little controversial to say it, but Detroit is a proud African American city, always will be, and that's great. But we elected this white dude, who's got dogged, fantastic. We love this guy, he's not a charismatic guy. He's very different than the traditional. Although Mike's now going to hit me over the head because I called him non-charismatic. But I mean, he's not a traditional Detroit kind of or big city politician. I mean, he's just getting stuff done. So all this stuff happened in a kind of a non-traditional way. I'm glad it happened, but I just don't know what the strategy that was that actually got us there.
Okay, well, let's grab some folks from the audience. Oh, got all sorts of hands.
So in light of Flint and trying to get some understanding of that, I'd like to hear more insight about the whole, on the state level, the emergency manager, in addition to, I've heard that the state of Michigan, so it's not just Detroit, but the state of Michigan voted that away, and then the legislation brought it back. I'd like to get some insight into that aspect of it in light of Flint and Detroit and the government side.
I think we should have Jennifer answer that question. Amazing. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah. We've had an emergency manager law in Michigan since the early 1980s, and it's actually a creature of the Home Rule Cities Act, which creates local government. So local government is not a right that's expressed in our Constitution. It's created by statute. Cities are created by statute, and they are created on a bargain that you will manage yourselves according to the fiscal strictures that the state imposes. The emergency manager law was created when the downturn started to happen in a lot of cities, and cities got themselves into a lot of debt that they couldn't sustain. They made a lot of promises to employees that they didn't invest in properly, and they were starting to really teeter on their budgets. It was a very weak law for a very long time that didn't allow this manager to come in and really change things fundamentally. Rick Snyder, who was elected in 2010, came in and said, I'm going to change that law. I'm going to give that some real teeth. And that person is going to be able to do just about anything, I mean, without any sort of Democratic check on it. That law got voted. There was a referendum about that law that was buried in a referendum of six different ballot initiatives, so it was really hard to tell what people were really saying. They did vote it away, but of course our legislature, which the way things are set up in Michigan, they can come back even after a voter referendum and reinstate essentially the same law. There's nothing that prevents them from doing it. I had never seen them do that before. Mm-hmm. And generally the political consequences for something like that would be pretty steep. In this case, there really weren't any. The legislature came back, reestablished the law, and for good measure, put what they call an appropriation in it. And there's a provision of law in Michigan that prevents, if there is an appropriation with the law, it's not subject to referendum. So we couldn't vote on it a second time. The new law has worked different ways in different cities, to be honest. In Detroit, it was key to getting all of the things done that were done. The person they hired to be the emergency manager in Detroit was this super competent bankruptcy lawyer with a long track record of getting good settlements for mostly private businesses that were going through the bankruptcy process. But the law has been used a lot, and there are a lot of cities that are in trouble. And so Flint is a really good example mm-hmm. of what can go wrong with that law. I mean, the emergency manager was not the person who did what was what led to the poisoning there, but that person didn't stand up and say, hey, wait a second, this is probably not going to work the way we think it is. Going forward, there's probably going to be significant changes to the law to add more democratic checks on it. That's something that I think is probably a good idea. But it's also just, you know, the emergency manager law is a tool to sort of manage cities once they've gotten into financial crisis. It doesn't deal with the reasons they got into that financial crisis. It doesn't deal with, after the financial crisis is over, how do you stay out of trouble in the future? Well, I mean, this is Flint's second trip through emergency manager. There's several other cities that went in and went out. I've written pretty consistently during this debate about the broader context of disinvestment in cities in Michigan, state, federal. That's what's really driving the problems. The emergency manager law is not it's not policy so much as it is reaction. And I've been on the governor's back a lot about a broader urban reinvestment strategy that I think should be part of his administration that he's not really taken to. I mean, he's pretty adamantly stuck to his guns that the emergency manager law is all he needs to help cities. I think Sandy would probably disagree.
Supposedly the mechanism, I agree with 99% of what Stephen says, and the 1% that I don't agree with, I'm probably wrong on, and that's kind of our Stephen my shtick. The only reason I disagree with Stephen just a little bit is that there is a mechanism. It's a financial review board that takes place after you come out of emergency management to kind of monitor the cities or the municipalities' decisions. It's not a decision-making body, but it's if you're going to spend lots of money, you have to go to them. And that's kind of the check and balance. And Detroit is working very, very well. The one thing I do want to say one thing about the Flint story. I mean, you know, obviously this water thing is beyond
tragic. But unfortunately, what gets a little lost in there is that I will certainly agree with Stephen, and I think I'm going to get this right, is that, you know, emergency management in the state of Michigan has had a very mixed result. Some of them are very, very successful, like the Detroit case. Flint, obviously, the Flint water thing shows what can go wrong when it's not clear who's in charge, and I think that's kind of what the story was there. But the issue that was trying to be resolved through emergency management in Flint was largely successful. I mean, there was a lot of financial problems in Flint due to lots of different issues. They had largely kind of come out of that. Their downtown was revitalizing. There were a lot of really good things. Again, far from being out of the woods yet. But, you know, Flint was on a trajectory of being in a much better place than it was prior to emergency management. Was emergency management the reason for that? Probably in some to some form or fashion. Does that make the water thing okay? Absolutely not. I'm not trying to defend the water thing at all, but I think it's important to look at emergency management kind of in its whole. And I think it's been at best a mixed record, but in some cases it's been quite successful.
But again, Flint's a great example, right? Mm-hmm. So over the last decade and a half, Flint has lost something like 50% of the jobs in the city, right? Even as its suburbs, which were created in large measure to keep people in one place, some people in one place and other people in another, its suburbs have done really, really well and come way up in the world. You look at transit in Flint. There's a transit system in Flint that doesn't go really beyond the borders of Flint. So if you live in Flint and need a job, more likely that job is outside the city of Flint. If you're poor, don't have a car, how are you going to get there? I mean, these are the problems that are driving cities' issues in Michigan, and Flint is an example. Detroit's an example. Emergency management can't fix those things.
Right.
Not even just designed to do it. And so, if you have an emergency manager law, but you don't have a broader, comprehensive strategy for reinvesting in urban cores, you end up with things like what we saw in Flint.
Okay, let's see if we can't get. Oh, my gosh, the host is holding a microphone. I'm not sure what that means. Does that mean you want to say something, or are you prepared to hand it to somebody else?
Question.
Okay. Go ahead, Amy.
I have a question for Rip. You mentioned at the beginning that this was a marathon while also trying to deal with the sprint. So I want to focus on the long-term vision. We covered a lot of ground here, and I am curious what's next. You know, how do you, with you all your collaborators, think about the need to continue the market traction in the city while dealing with a lot of the core issues that have been flagged on this panel?
I think the really short answer is you pivot into the neighborhoods, and you carry into the neighborhoods the entire toolbox you've deployed over the last decade along the Central Business District and its major arterial. You can do commercial corridor development with many of the same lending tools, many of the same sort of set of innovative, creative land use strategies that you did along the corridor. You can begin using your anchor institutions to create a different sense of how a place is anchored and how you do live-work-buy programs in a neighborhood. You can use the land that Stephen referred to. We have 40 square miles of vacant and abandoned land in Detroit. That's the size of the city of San Francisco. You can view that as a liability, or you can view it as an asset that no other city in America has, and begin doing the kind of sort of innovative reuse and repurposing of land that could be new residential, it could be open space, it could be green blue infrastructure, it could be 10 million things. I think in many ways, Detroit's capacity to be innovative on its land use front may well be its defining character into the next generation. You begin kind of creating neighborhoods of opportunity where you begin clustering small but, you know, important sort of traction laying steps like early childhood centers, upgraded residential and recreational centers. I mean, I think it will take a long time. But my sense is that now that Quentin is committing however $100 million, $1,000 million into Detroit. I mean, the numbers are just staggering. Last I heard, it was $1 billion he's committing into Detroit.
Yeah. We're going to be a broke investor.
Now that we've got that fixed. But, you know, there have been a whole suite of articles, national and local, to exactly Quentin's point earlier on, that the markets are finding their way back, but they're finding their way back to particular geographies. And I think to Stephen's point, they're not finding their way back to all geographies. And I think, frankly, that philanthropy, partnering with the government, has to sort of use the same playbook and has to get out front with some risk capital, try to figure out what those sort of guarantees of value are in neighborhoods, what do we need to have in place to give the private sector confidence that it can return. And I think then slowly, slowly, you begin creating a much different kind of neighborhood urban fabric than what we have now. Because right now, I think it's terribly out of balance, and it can't remain that way. Otherwise, you know, there won't be enough people to fill Quentin's homes. So I think that's right.
And when we figure it out in Detroit, let's bring it to Chicago to address our ills as well.
Yeah. I'm sorry, there have been lots of hands. I don't know how folks want to handle this.
Lots of questions.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm in commercial real estate, and my mom's from Detroit. But I haven't heard anyone talk about making the development numbers work by doing what we had to do in D.C., which was new market tax credits, TIFs, utilizing hub zones, just all of those instruments that are available. I haven't heard anybody talking about that.
I'll let you guys set this up, but I would call your attention to a piece this morning, I believe, it's Wall Street Journal, that took five innovative communities across the world, and one of their examples was Detroit, and creating pink zones where you essentially lift up sort of regulatory overlays and permit things to go in that simply wouldn't be permitted. I think it sort of goes back to my point that you're right, that we have sort of no excuse not to innovate. They're just, it's too hard, it's too hidebound, and I think one of the advantages we have, having come out of the bankruptcy, is that I think there's a real appetite for, and I think increasing facility for, using that kind of innovation. But why don't you guys talk about that?
And just very quickly, that those tools are critically important, particularly in addressing the market outside of the central business district, along with EB-5, the Visa program, and other initiatives that help share the risk and share the costs of new project development. But in the downtown core, we believe whether it's Chicago or New York or Detroit, it is critical to have a thriving, robust core. That core, at least as we see it in the city of Detroit, is that 7.2 square mile area that is a central business and residential district of Detroit. In those markets, in that market specifically, market rents, given that there's such undersupply, market rents are more than adequate to cover the cost of construction and provide an adequate return on those costs without new market tax credits and the like. So our focus, because we're a market-driven investor, is in this downtown core area. But Stephen's points, as well as Sandy's, those points are critical. You can't have a city of Oz gleaming and beautiful and have decay and misery surrounding it, or ultimately that gleaming city will fail.
We're running up against some time constraints, so I've been told that we have time for two more. You have a Twitter question? Go ahead.
This question comes from Zach Combs. Should the main job creation strategy in Detroit be attracting outside firms or scaling resident-owned businesses?
Did everybody hear the question?
Should the main job creation strategy be attracting outside firms or scaling resident-owned businesses?
Yes.
Yeah, really, why should it be? Yeah.
It's not an either or.
Yeah. Of course
Could I just quickly put in a plug for the latter? I mean, I think that the mayor and Sandy and others are doing a really good job of trying to influence the Quentins of the world to come in and put a real stake in the ground. But you got to figure out how the barber shop, the local tech firm, the local art gallery, the local bakery has a real running go at it. I remember sitting on the stage at a major conference, and someone said, well, how can you possibly build an economic strategy on a small business strategy? And I think in many ways that's the real choice we have in the neighborhood structures that prevail in Detroit. You just have to grow these one by one, 10 employees here, 13 employees there, 50 employees there, and hope that over time it creates this flywheel again that leads to a sort of a broader diversification. At the same time, you're anchoring with sort of major investments like the Quicken Loans, like the Illich Families Arena Project, you know, on and on and on. But I don't think you can choose. I think you would be really ill-advised to choose. So I don't mean to take away from the panel, but
yeah. I think it's fine.
Can we do one more question? Poor Cliff. I called him out by name, so he probably needs the opportunity to have a response.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Rip.
Cliff, you only wear a tie when you're in Washington and not in Detroit. How does that work?
I'm not wearing one. Yeah,
trying to follow the good example of Mr. Henderson up there. So I work for the White House Office of Management and Budget. I'm just the latest leader of a really significant federal effort that's tried to play its role a little bit behind the scenes or in partnership with the other sectors. I would just be remiss if I didn't stick up for my boss far up the chain and remind us that in 2008 and 9, the president invested $80 billion in the recovery of the auto industry, really an existential bet on his part that was not even popular on the Democratic side of the aisle at the time that he made that investment. So I think that should be given its due as one element as well. And in the federal government has tried in many of its projects to play that partnership role that Quentin referred to be a partner in the M1 rail and the Regional Transit Authority, to be a partner in the relighting of the city with technical assistance on LED lights, to help in the purchase of new buses, 80 new buses that were purchased for the city of Detroit. But my question is, how do we carry that partnership through to these three major challenges that Rip identified at the beginning, which are crime, which are schools, and which are transit? And there are proposals, as we all know, for schools, the reformulation of a school authority, and the business community has a strong voice there that perhaps they could step up to. The transit, the M1 rail is a great success, but it's only 3.3 miles. We need to build farther on that. How can the business community and philanthropy help there? And on public safety, in the downtown campus Martius area, we have a lot of private security that's made that a safe place to be. So my question is, I'm interested in how we continue this partnership on these three major challenges that are really citywide.
Well, we've extended this session till 5 o'clock because we do have a hard stop, and I do apologize for that. Can I ask each one of you to kind of give your best 30 seconds on Cliff's enormously complicated question?
Sure.
I'm going to treat it a little bit like a rhetorical question, but nevertheless.
And I give my 30 seconds to Jennifer.
Okay.
You have a minute.
All yours, Jennifer.
Without, you know, getting into the specifics, I think the key word here is partnership, though. I mean, if you look at what's been happening in Detroit on the ground and the deep involvement of the stakeholders in not just starting to set your own agenda, in setting your own agenda for the types of activities you want to get done. And I think, you know, the best kind of partnership is for the federal government to be taking its lead from the local stakeholders, because you have the best sense of where that investment is most needed, and where the federal government particularly can play the best role in helping to support those investments. So, you know, I think whether it's on crime, whether it's on education or any of these issues, it's, you know, it really comes back to the federal government not creating a situation where you have to sort of respond and grab at whatever the federal government's offering, but rather being able to set your own plans and having the feds be able to come in and say, we recognize what you're trying to do and here's how we can be supportive.
Brent, you want to reclaim your 30 seconds?
Just 10 seconds. Just the best thing that the federal government, in my opinion, can do is create an overall macro environment that's favorable. And certainly President Obama, in addition to taking the TARP money, which was not designated for things like saving Detroit and allocated that money to Detroit, is quite revolutionary. But even more revolutionary is the fact that we took our pain, and through his leadership in Congress and the Federal Bank, we're in a great spot today where the rest of the world is suffering. Europe still is mired in pain. Overall global growth is slowing. The United States has diverged from the rest of the world with a very, very strong economy, which helps the city of Detroit.
Stephen.
I think I'm going to be the wild-eyed optimist up here with this. A friend of mine suggested something that I think is a really interesting idea, decommissioning Detroit, right? When the federal government forces a local community, for instance, to build up around a base, a military base, and then pulls that base away, there's this tremendous effort to backfill, right, to figure out how to descale. Detroit is the same way. Detroit was built the way it was, largely on the sort of say-so of the federal government. Largely during the war, the war effort changed Detroit fundamentally. We've lost all those people who came to the city to help with that. Why not have, you know, almost a Marshall Plan size decommissioning of the city, reimagine it as a smaller place where there's opportunity for the people who are left behind? That would be more than $80 billion, though.
Sandy, you get the last word.
So just I thank Cliff. Cliff's done a great job in his team, and I certainly applaud the Obama administration for what they did in the auto industry. As someone who worked for President Bush on the early days of the auto bailout, I always like to remind people that, you know, we had a role in that too, that everyone likes to overlook. The auto industry may not have been there by the time Obama took office had we not taken some of the steps. And I know I worked on that. I was part of the president's staff doing that. But I think, you know the federal role has been really important, particularly around blight removal. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can really overstate how important the federal government has been in the blight removal of Detroit. That's not a something that the private sector was well equipped to basically handle on their own. And so I really thank the federal government on blight removal.
It's tempting to drive all of these into the next couple of hours of conversation, but I think we need to be done. So please thank the panelists for our great conversation.